Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nick Pasquale. I'm the president of IFA Canada, and I want to welcome everyone to this webinar, which is presented by IFA's Young IFA Network. This is the second webinar that Yin has hosted, and we're pleased with the number of individuals that have registered for this webinar from across the country. And at the outset, I do want to thank Davies for making their facilities available to us here in Toronto and also in Montreal, and also to Blake's for the facilities they've made available in Vancouver. Want to express on behalf of IFA Council a warm welcome to everyone who is attending their first IFA Anything. That is one of the purposes for us hosting these types of events. Those that are members of the Canadian Tax Foundation Young Practitioners are certainly welcome that you're participating with us on this webinar. For those that are not familiar with YIN, YIN was an organization that was created by IFA, and it's a global network designed for young tax practitioners from across around the world, really. To provide them with forums such as these and other opportunities to become more engaged with colleagues in other firms, to get them more involved in international tax matters, such as what we're doing here today, talking about what I think have been pretty significant that the government has introduced. And in particular, to give them that opportunity to get to know some of those in other firms. And we're certainly in Canada have embraced the YIN network under the leadership first of Patrick Marley of Osler's and now Michael Kenda of Davies, who's the other moderator for this session. I certainly encourage you to take advantage of these types of opportunities as we present them, to become engaged. As a practitioner now for well over 25 years, I can certainly think back to what it would have been great to have been able to have these types of opportunities earlier in my career to network with other firms. And I think certainly as you do so, you'll come to appreciate the ability to converse with colleagues in other firms, network with them. This is to a large extent about personal development, to make you better practitioners and better advisors for your clients, and we want to be able to contribute to that development. So I encourage you to participate in these types of things and to express your views in terms of the types of things you'd like to see more of in terms of webinars. Keeping in mind, of course, that YIN and being part of IFA is focused on international tax matters, and so for instance, you know, we're not in competition for the young tax practitioners. The Canadian Tax Foundation, in fact, we are working collaboratively with them in a number of areas, all with the same goal of engaging some of our younger tax practitioners. So I encourage you also to keep in contact with us through our website, ifacanada.org. Join IFA if you're not already. It's a really a nominal amount. It's a very small investment in your future, and we certainly would welcome you to be members of IFA if you're not already. I've now done my part, so I can turn the heavy lifting over to the others, and in particular, heading off to Michael in Montreal.
Thank you, Nick. Can you guys hear us?
Loud and clear.
Great. So thank you, Nick. This is Michael Kandev. I'm a partner at Davies. I'm the YIN representative for Canada. I'm very honored to make a quick presentation of our very good speakers today. So we're honored to have Derek Chiasson of Norton Rose here in Montreal sitting just right next to me. And then we have Jeff Alderwinning of Moskowitz Meredith in Toronto. Both of them were actively involved working on the CICA-CBA Joint Committee representations to finance on the FA dumping proposals So we have a pair of excellent speakers who have a lot of knowledge and understanding of these rules, and we're honored to have them today to give us a little bit of, to share their knowledge about them with us. So without further ado, I'll pass it on to Derek, who's, as I said, right next to me.
Thanks very much, Michael. Hopefully, with that, that the great introduction, hopefully will be up to satisfying the expectations created by that introduction. Just as a initial comment in terms of background, and we'll get very quickly into the examples of the types of transactions that are targeted by the foreign affiliate dumping rules. Just as a general introduction, though, some of these proposals kind of came out, and you know, Nick may differ on whether or not they actually reflect the recommendations of the Advisory Panel on International Taxation. But some of these proposals did result from the recommendations of that Advisory Panel on International Taxation, you know, targeting certain types of transactions that are seen as either eroding the Canadian tax base or in some other way abusive. So I'll pass it on to Jeff to deal with the first type of targeted transaction, debt dumping.
Right. Thanks, Derek. In the interest of time, we can maybe skip right ahead, thanks, Derek, to the first targeted transaction that was listed on that first slide. We'll call this a classic leveraged FA dump. And what's going on in this transaction is U.S. parent is transferring the shares of UK Co. to CanCo in consideration for CanCo shares and a promissory note. And the amount of the promissory note is calibrated to produce enough thin cap room in order to allow CanCo to deduct interest expense in order to shelter Canadian source taxable income, say it's got a business in Canada, for example. And that is eroding the Canadian tax base, and it's producing a tax benefit. Meanwhile, the UK Co., when it pays dividends to CanCo out of its exempt surplus, those are exempt from tax in Canada. And furthermore, when CanCo pays interest on the note in reliance on the treaty, that interest payment is exempt from Canadian withholding tax. So you can see this structure is extremely tax efficient. You may almost say to yourself it's almost too good to be true. And I think that reflects a mixing, really, of the computation of Canadian source income with foreign source income. And what I mean by that is you can generate a deduction that reduces your Canadian taxable income, even though that deduction is really linked to the production of exempt foreign source income. Even so, these types of transactions have been at least tolerated, I think, in the past. And I think part of that is because there are spillover benefits that accrue to Canada in this type of transaction. For example, if you may see technology transfers from the UK Co. to CanCo, where CanCo might use some of that technology in its own business, and that might help to close, say, the productivity gap that we face here in Canada. Another benefit might be CanCo creates treasury function jobs here in Canada, and those are high-paying, high-skilled jobs, and that benefits all of us. So that seemed to be the former policy, is that this transaction was at least tolerated. Now, with the FA dumping rules, it's clear there's been a change in policy where this transaction won't be tolerated. It'll be attacked under the foreign affiliate dumping rules, and we'll get to how it's attacked later. But I would like to pause here to look at what exactly the policy change is. I mean, some say it's willy-nilly. It's really no coherent policy whatsoever. It's just closing a loophole in order to generate revenue in a time of budgetary deficits, and I think that's a legitimate view. Others have advanced the view that there's an industrial policy aspect to this insofar as that tax benefit to CanCo is really akin to an implicit subsidy that's given to multinationals by the Canadian Fisc. And that implicit subsidy, it may well be now that finance wants to tailor that implicit subsidy as only being conferred on Canadian multinationals and not foreign-controlled multinationals, primarily on the basis that foreign control tips the cost-benefit analysis to the extent that the full benefit of the implicit subsidy isn't inuring to Canadians exclusively and in an unfettered fashion. Whether you swallow that or not, I don't know. But some have advanced that. We note here on the last bullet, apart from the foreign affiliate dumping approach, which we're going to talk about in a minute, if you think creatively, you could have maybe come up with other approaches to attack this type of transaction. We've got listed here a change to the foreign affiliate thin cap rule, whereby you might say, well, when you're computing the thin cap room for Canco, just deny the puck in the Canco shares that's traceable to a foreign affiliate dump. And that might, by reducing the thin cap room, then deny Canco its interest deduction and attack the transaction in a direct way without sort of overbroad foreign affiliate dumping rules that we see now.
I think just to interject there, Jeff, I think one of the comments that was made by the advisory panel on international taxation was a recommendation to, rather than play with the thin cap rules or with interest deductibility rules, that there be kind of a specific anti-avoidance rule dealing with debt dumping. Although, I guess, like Jeff says, you may disagree as to what the appropriate approach is to be taken. Here what we have is a set of rules that are much broader than kind of this kind of single avoidance issue that was identified by the panel, which was debt dumping. These rules are much broader than debt dumping. And in that context, you end up with this whole set of rules, new set of rules that you have to worry about when you have any kind of investments being made into foreign affiliates by foreign-controlled Canadian corporations. And what's interesting is you might think that kind of no harm, no foul if you didn't have a debt dump. For instance, if rather than have the transaction that's shown on the screen here, you had simply Canco acquiring the shares of UKCo in consideration for the issuance of its own shares, you might say, well, why is that a problem? Because the UKCo wasn't under Canco before. Canada wasn't going to get any tax out of UKCo before. Now UKCo is under Canada. And Canada may at some point get withholding tax if the dividends are paid out of Canco. And I guess that's where the other rules come in, which is what we're going to talk about. And one of them is looking at this as kind of a surplus strip by Canada, and the impact of this kind of transaction, even if you didn't have debt dumping, is an increase in the paid-up capital of the Canadian company, which allows you to extract funds out of Canada other than funds that might be generated by this UKCo. That's kind of where they're going with the other rules. So, Jeff, I guess I can move on to the next slide.
Yeah, sure.
So if we look at the next one, which is the surplus stripping type transaction, this one is kind of along the lines of the Collins and Aikman type transaction, where had there been no U.S. co in this chart, and the U.S. parent would have transferred Canco to New Canco, U.S. parent would have been stuck with the low puck in Canco because of 212.1, and potentially if it took back boot on the transfer into Canco, it would have had a deemed dividend. So 212.1 doesn't catch this type of structure where the Canadian company is actually under a foreign corporation, and the foreign corporation is transferred to a new Canco. And Collins and Aikman quite clearly established that this type of thing wouldn't be subject to GAR, at least not on the facts in Collins and Aikman. And so these rules seek to prohibit this type of transaction. The consequence of this type of transaction is that you will increase the puck. So USCO in this transaction ends up getting liquidated after being transferred under New Canco. New Canco and Canco are amalgamated. And then what you've just done is increase the puck, the cross-border puck into Canada, which increases your thin cap room and also facilitates returns of capital from Canada to the U.S. parent. These rules target this type of transaction to prevent you from getting that puck increase or to deem a dividend in this context. So you would think that in this type of fact pattern, you know, one of the things that could have been done is to amend 212.1 to make it apply even to a transfer of a foreign corporation to the extent that there was an underlying Canadian corporation. But that wouldn't have entirely resolved some of the issues that they're focused on. But you know, that could have been a solution. You could have also applied 212.1 even in a non-arm's length acquisition context. So if this wasn't U.S. parent contributing the U.S. Co. stock to New Canco, but a foreign seller or a Canadian seller selling the stock of U.S. Canco to New Canco owned by a U.S. parent, you could have also extended 212.1 to apply even in arm's length context like that. But what's been chosen is a more complex solution. I think what's interesting is you kind of look at this and you say, well, it's true you could do this kind of transaction, but you need a specific set of circumstances, i.e., you know, you need that when the U.S. parent transfers U.S. co-stock under New Canco, you don't want U.S. parent to have a gain on which they're paying tax in the U.S. So you need a set of circumstances where you either have no gain in the foreign country or you have a participation exemption, for instance. So I'll let Jeff take over.
Yeah, thanks, Derek. I think that's right. Maybe it's enough just to advance to the next slide. I know some people were speculating about changes to 212.1 in the 2012 budget. Instead, we got foreign affiliate dumping that covered that particular transaction that we highlighted there. So the third type of targeted transactions that we're going to explore here are non-strategic business expansions. So in this diagram, we have a U.S. parent that owns a four co-sister of the CRIC that engages in a particular line of business, and we have the CRIC and its foreign affiliate that carry on a different line of business. We have an exempt dividend paid by the foreign affiliate to the CRIC, and the CRIC uses the proceeds to make a preferred share investment in Forco. And this transaction, to some extent, you might conceive that it avoids Part 13 tax to the extent that CRIC didn't repatriate those earnings to the U.S. parent to make the investment in Forco directly, as you might expect. So there is that aspect to it in terms of tax efficiency. There's also the implication that Forco pays exempt dividends to the CRIC that don't fall within the Canadian tax net. We don't enlarge the Canadian tax base really through this preferred share investment because it's fixed value and it doesn't participate. That's a tax-efficient transaction. And the mischief, again, is a perceived failure, I think, to repatriate to the U.S. parent or otherwise to deploy the earnings in Canada to earn taxable income in Canada. And finance seems to assimilate this with base erosion. And I think ultimately finance just doesn't want the CRIC to make portfolio investments in foreign sisters like this as an alter ego for the U.S. parent. They expect repatriation, or at least they've imposed a policy in the form of a rule that will deem a dividend to arise in that circumstance.
What's kind of interesting is that it really looks a lot like a branch tax. It looks like a lot like a branch tax on foreign-controlled Canadian corporations. So if the CRIC here were to invest in its Canadian business, you wouldn't have a problem. You know, because the CRIC is investing outside of Canada, then you have a deemed dividend under these rules. So it's kind of, you know, like Jeff says, it's getting at, you know, forcing a CRIC to distribute its surplus to the parent in order to allow the parent to invest in the foreign entity rather than investing directly. And it really, you know, to me, really strikes of a branch tax on foreign-controlled Canadian corporations.
Right. Dealing with the last bullet, what else could maybe finance have done to the extent it found this transaction offensive. I mean, we brainstormed a few here. You might deem the Forco not to be a foreign affiliate of the CRIC so that it denies the CRIC the 113 deduction, for example, or else to the extent, you know, preferred share investment to be a loan on the basis of some sort of a debt substitute and impute interest on that deemed loan in a manner that's akin to Section 17. Another approach might be just to deem the exempt dividends paid by Forco to be interest payments. I guess one drawback there would be that then you have some control over the timing of the incidence of the tax, so there may be perpetual deferral available, so that might not be much of a solution. But there are other approaches, I think, that could have been taken other than the rules that we actually got. So, Derek, maybe I can pass the mic to you.
Sure. Okay. So, so now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of it, I guess, in terms of what the conditions of application of these rules are. And if you, essentially, and Jeff will get to what is an investment in a subject corporation, because it really is a very broad category of investments, as you probably know. So you need to have an investment in a subject corporation by a CRIC, which is a Canadian resident corporation that's controlled by a foreign parent, and the subject corporation immediately after the time of the investment or as part of the series that includes the investment becomes a foreign affiliate of the CRIC, and the CRIC is controlled by a foreign parent at the time, investment time, or as part of the series. So what's interesting about this is that it's a series type of determination. So you may, for instance, have a situation where the foreign corporation is not a foreign affiliate immediately before it becomes a foreign affiliate as a result of the investment, which is, I guess, easy enough to do. But what's interesting is that you may have, for instance, a CRIC that acquires an interest in a foreign corporation, but is not yet controlled by a foreign parent at that point in time. But then if, as part of the series, it becomes controlled by the foreign parent, then that investment by the CRIC that might have occurred before the acquisition of control could be targeted by these rules. Another important thing to mention is that these rules affect new investments for existing structures, so it doesn't only apply to kind of new acquisitions of foreign affiliates by a CRIC. So, for instance, if a foreign multinational has already structured its affairs having a Canadian holding company with a lot of foreign affiliates under it, then that seriously impedes that Canadian parent, if you want, from financing its foreign affiliates without proceeding by way of some sort of injection of equity or otherwise from the parent. Or a PUC suppression that results from the investment in the foreign affiliate. So it really causes a major headaches for foreign controlled Canadian multinationals in terms of their investments in foreign affiliates that they already have and that were not structured that way to gain any kind of tax benefit. Although, you know, everybody's very, I'm sure they're all very happy about having exempt surplus treatment on their dividends.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, yes. So the next slide, as Derek promised, I'll deal with what do we mean by an investment in a subject corporation. It's a defined phrase in subsection 10. So depicted on the left there is an example of the types of transactions that are covered. I'll go through them quickly. The first is an acquisition of shares of the foreign affiliate by either CRIC. Second is a contribution of capital to the foreign affiliate by either CRIC. The third is generally a loan to the foreign affiliate, other than trade debts that are repaid quickly, or a pertinent loan or indebtedness, which Derek referred to, and he'll explain in greater detail later. The fourth item is an acquisition of a debt obligation of a foreign affiliate by either CRIC, and that's really a transaction substitute for making a loan, I think. The fifth one is interesting. It's an extension of a maturity date of a loan. And in the abstract, you might say that's not even really a transaction. But there's a special deeming rule in subsection 5 that effectively treats that as a repayment of the loan and then a fresh reloan. So you do have a transfer of property basically in the amount of the amount owing on the debt. The sixth item also deserves, I think, further comment.
Jeff, before you get to that, just one thing that I wanted to add on the extension of the maturity date or the extension of a redemption date is that, you know, to the extent that those types of things are done, you know, without any kind of tax planning in mind, it's quite possible that a taxpayer would do those things without even consulting a tax advisor and kind of end up getting a bit of a surprise when they find out that they have a deemed dividend.
Yeah, absolutely. That is an unhappy event, I think. So the indirect acquisition rule, I want to give some context here because the 2012 federal budget actually didn't have this rule, at least not in this form. Instead, what it had was any transaction or event that's similar in effect to any of the covered transactions. And it seemed to be, at least to me when reading that budget proposal, I thought it was a supporting rule to basically preserve the integrity of the other main rules. When we got the legislative proposals in August, it was a bit of an interesting read to see that we had essentially this rule that the threshold was 50%. It's now augmented to 75%. But basically, it was the rule in this form. It was redrafted to cover any acquisition of shares of a CanCo that derives more than 75% of its value from foreign affiliates. And that test obviously has no circumvention-type motive in it. It's just seemingly reading right as a rule. And this caused some consternation, I think, because it catches acquisitions of shares of Canadian pubcos, for example. And people were concerned about the impact on Canadian capital markets. Nevertheless, the rule is what it is. And there are some hints that it's really aimed at arm's length acquisitions. And where I get that from is you can see that it covers acquisitions of shares of a CanCo, but it doesn't cover things like a contribution of capital. So say if CRIC makes a contribution of capital to CRIC 2 and CRIC 2 invests in the Canadian business, that rule is not caught. So it gives some flexibility to existing foreign controlled multinationals where say the Alcans of the world or Incos or something to plan around it. But if you're intending to come in as a new investor and you intend to participate, you're buying shares. And so that's why I say, at least to my own mind, it really does target arm's length acquisitions. The last item on the list is transactions similar in effect like options, interest, or rights. Derek, do you have any thoughts on that slide?
Yeah, I mean, I think on going back to the 75% test, I think, you know, one of the, as Jeff says, I mean, the real problem, even increasing the threshold from 50 to 75%, I mean, you could still have situations where for instance, a foreign corporation sets up a Canadian corporation to acquire shares of a Canadian public company. And at some point, you know, maybe they just need maybe financing shares, and you know, because it's, you know, the requirement is that as part of the series, the foreign affiliate under the Canadian corporation becomes a foreign affiliate of the CRIC. I mean, if you acquire, for instance, if there are a specific, say, one class of shares, a new class of shares that's issued, let's say in a preferred share financing, and more than 10% of those shares are acquired by the Canadian corporation that's been set up by the foreign investor, then, you know, boom, you have a foreign affiliate, and that investment is targeted by these rules. So it's quite broad and quite problematic, I think, in the public markets, even with this higher 75% threshold. You know, you look at, I was looking recently at some you know, public disclosure documents of some public companies, and I mean, some of them, it's quite obvious that they're 100% foreign affiliates. But I mean, any kind of operating company that has operations in Canada, you don't really see that, and you can't really tell in the financial statements or otherwise what proportion of their value is really derived from their shares in foreign affiliates. So it becomes almost like kind of almost like hearsay as to what proportion of their value is derived from foreign affiliates. You could really fall into this rule without any kind of abusive intent.
Yeah, I guess one comment I do have, I want to concede for finance. I mean, you need some sort of a rule that avoids an easy packaging of the foreign affiliates into a CRIC and then have the vendor sell the shares of the CRIC and say, well, dust your hands, I'm not caught. So you do need something along these lines, but to me, it would be nice to see an anti-avoidance rule that deals with that kind of a motive test for the transaction rather than this test.
Yeah, I mean, that's my point.
Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. So if we go to one of the other exceptions is the PLOI pertinent loan or indebtedness exception, called a PLOI, which is a bit of an unfortunate acronym, but so it means an amount owing by a foreign affiliate to a CRIC if the amount became owing after March 28, 2012, so after budget date, or if there was an extension of the maturity date of the debt obligation after the budget date, and the amount isn't the trade debt repaid within 180 days, which goes back to the other exception that that Jeff mentioned, goes back to the exclusion, in other words, from the investment definition. So a trade debt that's repaid within 180 days is not an investment. And if the CRIC and the foreign parent jointly elect in writing in respect of the amount owing. So as initially proposed, the PLOI election was for all debts, whereas now it's on a debt-by-debt basis, so it permits you to select which ones you want to do the PLOI election for. The consequence of being a PLOI is that you're deemed to the CRIC is deemed to realize actual or deemed interest income at least equal to what's essentially the prescribed rate on the late payment of taxes, which is currently 5%. So in other words, if your interest rate is over 5%, there's no problem. You include that in that higher interest rate. But if your interest rate is under 5%, you're stuck with the prescribed rate. So I guess it's similar to Section 17 in that respect, you'd want to have a fluctuating interest rate if you wanted to make sure that the interest that was actually payable and that the CRIC received corresponded to the interest that would be deemed under this rule. I guess with that, I'll go on to the other exception, which is the strategic business expansion exception. So, I'll try to gloss over these a little bit, but I mean the general comment on the strategic business expansion exception, we will make a few specific comments on them, of course, as well. But in general, I think everyone is on the same page in saying that it will be very difficult for any corporation really to meet this test, absent a situation where you have a foreign private equity investor that controls the Canadian corporation. So kind of in any situation where you have a foreign parent corporation that actually operates a business, unless that business is totally different from the Canadian business, you're not going to be able to fit into this exception. So that's my personal view, that it's so narrow as to be almost useless, if you like. Maybe a bit too harsh of a comment, but one of the requirements in order to meet the strategic business expansion exception is that the business activities carried on by the foreign affiliate are expected to remain more closely connected to the business activities carried on in Canada by the CRIC than to the business activities carried of any related non-resident corporations other than foreign affiliates. So, other foreign affiliates of the CRIC. So, in other words, if they're closely connected, if they're as closely connected or more closely connected to businesses that are kind of above the line, if you want. When I say above the line, what I mean is businesses that are either sisters of the CRIC or that are above the CRIC in the corporate organization chart. So if there's a
an as close connection to those other businesses, you can't meet the test. So, you know, and the question is, how do you determine whether or not you're more closely connected? I mean, everybody can understand kind of conceptually how two businesses can be connected. I mean, for instance, if they're vertically integrated or horizontally integrated, you say, well, they're connected businesses, or they're the same types of businesses, so you'd say they're connected businesses. But how are they more closely connected? You know, consider, for instance, an integrated multinational enterprise. I mean, typically in those situations, you know, the business is carried on throughout the world, and, you know, all of the businesses work together, and typically the foreign parent is actually quite involved in any kind of strategic decision making by any of its subsidiaries, including the Canadian subsidiary, even though the Canadian subsidiary may run its own business and may have input in the operation of the foreign affiliates that it invests in. So that this more closely connected test, very, very difficult to meet. You know, I would have thought personally that it would have been sufficient to have you know, the other rule, a rule that was more conceptual based on whether or not there was perhaps even an as close connection, for instance. But you know, you might think of an example where, you know, are we saying that it's more closely connected? For instance, if the foreign affiliate is a supplier of the cricket, you know, does it have to be its only supplier? Does it have to only supply the cricket? What if it supplies somebody else in the group? You know, is it more closely connected to the cricket or to the foreign corporation that it also supplies product or services to? Same thing if it's a client. You know, if the foreign affiliate is a customer of the cricket. Well, what if it's also a customer of a related corporation that's above the line? You know, is that, can you say, well, it's more closely connected? Do I look at their volume of sales or their volume of purchases from each of them and say, well, if the volume of from one is higher than the other, then it's more closely connected? And what happens the following year? How do I make that determination? And how do I formulate an expectation that it's expected to remain more closely connected in those kinds of instances? So it's very difficult to satisfy that test. If we go to the next criteria that has to be satisfied, it's in the context of making the investment and the officers who are involved in making the investment in the foreign affiliate. And the test here, according to the technical notes, is really meant to make sure that the CRIC acts in the same type of manner as a Canadian multinational would have, so a Canadian-controlled multinational would have. In this context, we're talking about officers of the CRIC who exercise principal decision-making authority with respect to making the investment, and majority of them were resident and work principally in Canada or in the country in which a CFA is resident. So if you have officers of the CRIC, for instance, who are employees also of another controlled foreign affiliate, those officers who don't work principally in Canada but may work principally in a jurisdiction in which there's another controlled foreign affiliate located can satisfy this test. Those kind of foreign located officers can actually help satisfy this test. But in order to satisfy that test, the activities of the CFA of which those officers are officers must be at least as closely connected to those of the subject corporation, being the foreign affiliate in which the investment is being made, as those of the CRIC are to the subject corporation. So again, this closely connected test comes into play in this one. You know, again, a very difficult test, I think, to satisfy, particularly when you consider, foreign-controlled multinationals, you know, for the most part, have dotted line reporting to head office. Head office is often highly involved in strategic investments by its foreign subsidiaries. So who has principal decision-making authority? Mm-hmm. The third criteria is with respect to kind of the ongoing decisions in respect to the investment. And similar there's a similar problem here with respect to the connectedness issue, because part of the test in B here, when we talk about a majority of the officers being resident or working principally in Canada or the country in which a CFA is resident, we go back to the other test about the more close connect, the closer connection, or the as closely connected as the business of the CRIC is with the subject corporation. So again, the same kind of problem about the connection comes in. But the other problem with this test is the performance evaluation and compensation of the officers has to be based on the results of the operations of the subject corporation to a greater extent than any officer of a related non-resident corporation. So kind of, I'm sure we can all think of a few examples where it's a bit difficult to figure out how that one would exactly work. And what's kind of odd in my mind is that, here you have a tax rule that may in fact have an impact on performance evaluation or remuneration practices of a corporation in order to fit into these rules, which strikes me as being a bit overreaching. If you think about, one of the examples in the technical notes is that you take, for example, two officers who have bonuses and that are linked to the results of the subject corporation. If you have an officer, let's say an officer of the Canadian corporation and an officer of a disqualified corporation, both of whom receive remuneration that's in part based on the results of the subject corporation, then you have to ask yourself, is the remuneration of the CRIC's officer determined to a greater extent on the results of the subject corporation than the remuneration of this kind of disqualified officer? And what the technical notes say is, well, to the extent that the bonus of the Canadian guy represents a larger proportion of his total remuneration than the bonus of the non-qualifying person, then you satisfy this test. I mean, it just boggles my mind how you're supposed to apply this. Very, very restrictive. So I think we'll jump to. We'll jump to the next exception, Jeff, which is the reorg exception. Unless you have something to add on the strategic.
No, I think we've covered that. So we'll try to make quick work here, given time constraints. The reorganization exemption is the third exemption. Remember, the first is deploy, the second is the strategic business exception, the third is the reorg exception, and this exempts certain reorgs and certain distributions of foreign affiliate shares and specie effectively. And the premise is to exempt a transaction generally where there's no new investment being made. And what we mean by that is there's no incremental value being transferred by the CRIC to the foreign affiliate. And the reason that, at least that I see on a go-forward basis, the existing investment would already have been subject to these foreign affiliate dumping rules once. So to hit it again on the reorg would effectively be double tax on what amounts to the same investment. So that's, I think, the policy behind it. What's exempted? Well, this slide is going to cover two major categories. The first is a direct or indirect share acquisition by a CRIC from a related CanCo where the CRIC and the CanCo never deal with each other at arm's length at any point in the relevant series. Similarly, the same type of a share acquisition by an Amalco on a Section 87 amalgamation of related CanCos where those CanCos predecessors never deal with each other at arm's length at any point in the series. The second category there is an investment that's an acquisition of shares of a foreign affiliate by a CRIC for share-for-share exchanges at the foreign affiliate level, basically. And distributions of foreign affiliate shares and specie received by the CRIC from a foreign affiliate investee on a share redemption or a dividend or a return of capital. And I think what's going on there is basically you can think of that notionally as a recovery of the CRIC's original investment rather than making a fresh investment. So in the interest of time, I'll just move forward. Like any good rule, there's exceptions to the exception. There's a carve-out for preferred share investments that aren't participating. I think the theory there is just those are always bad. The second item is share exchanges to the extent that debt's assumed, and that I think is just a substitute transaction for a debt dump to some extent, because the CanCo then gets to deduct interest potentially against to reduce its Canadian taxable income. The third item is a series where you manipulate ownership to make people related in order to get access to this this exemption. I'll move ahead and talk about the tax consequences. We've discussed a little bit, I think, what the consequences are, but subject to a PUC suppression rule, which we're going to talk about later, and pausing there, the Canadian tax system allows a CRIC to pay a return of capital before a dividend. So PUC suppression is really a concession that allows the avoidance of a deemed dividend that imposes a cash cost, where otherwise, in fairness, they could have accessed pre-existing cross-border PUC. We'll get to that in a minute. But putting that aside, what are the consequences? Well, deemed dividend paid to the foreign parent by the CRIC that made the investment. And how much is the deemed dividend? Well, it's the amount of property transferred by the CRIC, basically to the foreign affiliate, other than CRIC shares. So CRIC shares are dealt with under paragraph B, and under that rule, the extent the foreign parent gets CRIC shares as consideration, for example, in our foreign affiliate dump example, what happens there is the PUC that's cross-border is ground to nil, so there's no creation of PUC by that foreign affiliate dumping transaction. There's a few other items here. I think I'll skip ahead just to the closing words on under paragraph A that can reasonably be considered to relate to the investment. What the heck's going on there? Well, that, I think, is dealing with the transaction that's depicted in red, where you have an indirect investment in a foreign affiliate by a CRIC that is an acquisition of shares of CRIC 2. In that case, you do have a 10F investment in a subject corporation, but how much is your investment? You basically have to allocate the purchase price pro rata amongst the property of CRIC 2. So, you know, if, for example, if you had 80% of the value of CRIC 2 is attributable to FA shares, you'd say how much of the investment can reasonably be considered to relate on a $100 investment, let's say, you'd say $80. And that's the amount of the deemed dividend that would be paid in that circumstance by the CRIC to the foreign parent. I would say, too, skipping to the last bullet on this slide, where you have an investment in a subject corporation by a low-tier CanCo, you can have a deemed dividend going to the foreign parent and in circumstances where the foreign parent's actually not a shareholder. And so then that attracts sort of the high treaty-reduced rate. The new budget bill actually provides a dividend substitution election that we'll talk about in a minute that provides relief in that circumstance. So, Derek, maybe I can advance the slide deck for you. Derek, do you want to talk about the tax consequences of the foreign affiliate dump?
Yeah, sorry about that. I was on mute.
No, it's okay.
I mean, in this one, the foreign affiliate dump, I mean, we saw this earlier on in the presentation. Jeff mentioned in the previous slide, the similarly here where the CanCo acquires UKCo from the parent and issues a note, and issues shares. So the total fair market value of UKCo is $17.50, while you have two things that go on here. You have, you have a deemed dividend, subject to the PUC suppression rules that we'll talk about. You have a deemed dividend of $10 for the note, and then you have a PUC grind of $7.50 on the shares that are issued by CanCo in consideration for the investment.
Right. So recall the second targeted transaction. What happens here? Remember, this is the Collins and Aikman type structure. U.S. parent contributes U.S. co-shares to New CanCo for New CanCo shares exclusively. So what happens is paragraph 2B applies to grind the new PUC of the shares of New CanCo to nil, so that completely frustrates the Collins and Aikman transaction. What you're trying to do is create cross-border PUC to either create thin cap room or to facilitate a return of capital free of withholding tax. And we know this is tantamount to an expansion, really, of 212.1 by other means. It really has the same effect, but it applies to the investment by New Canco in the U.S. co-shares, and it effectively extends 212.1 to a non-arm's length disposition by a non-resident of U.S. co-shares or foreign co-shares to a Canco.
And the last example before we get to dividend substitution is a non-strategic business expansion. Similarly to the other situations here, you know, Canco invests in foreign affiliate, assume that it doesn't meet the strategic business expansion. Subject to the PUC suppression rules, you have a deemed dividend of $10 by Canco to the parent. Because the parent is a U.S. parent here, for instance, you'd apply the 5% treaty reduced rate. If Canco and the U.S. parent elect to treat the loan as a ploy, then you know, as long as Canada has is accruing interest on the note of at least 5%, then you know you're good to go.
Right. So let's skip ahead to the dividend substitution election. Recall this diagram. I think we've seen it before, where you have a low tier CRIC making a direct investment, and we have a deemed dividend that effectively skips a level, and that imposes two problems really. One is the high withholding tax rate, and the other is the inability to eliminate that deemed dividend through PUC suppression of cross-border PUC. So what the rules in the budget bill allow you to do is to have, in this example, the foreign parent qualifying substitute corporation and the CRIC all jointly elect to deem that deemed dividend to be paid on the shares of the qualifying substitute corporation shares that are owned by the foreign parent. And that it solves your problem because now you've got the 5% withholding tax rate because the foreign parent is a shareholder of the QSC, and it gives you the ability to reduce that deemed dividend to the extent of the existing cross-border PUC in the shares of the QSC. We'll talk about this later, but the election has to be crafted carefully to stay eligible for PUC suppression. Basically, the rule is you need to allocate the deemed dividend so that it results in the maximum reduction of cross-border PUC that's available. The election can be late filed subject to penalty, and there's the definition of a qualifying substitute corporation, and you can think of it notionally as just what's depicted here. You've got foreign control. It owns an equity percentage in the CRIC, and the shares of the qualifying substitute corporation are owned by the foreign parent or whoever the non-resident corporation that doesn't deal at arm's length with the foreign parent on which or to which you're paying the deemed dividend as per your election. Yeah, maybe you can take it on, Derek.
Yep. So, I mean, on the PUC suppression, I think Jeff has described, you know, how it works. What's interesting is that it actually applies automatically under the new rules. But you have to be careful because, one, if you do the dividend substitution election, as Jeff indicated, the consequence of the election has to be to reduce the cross-border PUC essentially to the maximum extent possible. So, for instance, if you have companies that have corporations that have several shareholders, only some of which are non-residents or some of which are non-arm's length non-residents, and you have other companies other Canadian corporations, all of whose shareholders are non-arm's length non-residents. Well, because the PUC suppression actually suppresses PUC of the entire class, right? Then you're forced to suppress the PUC of the class in which the non-arm's length non-residents hold the highest proportion. So that's why the mention of you have to be careful about the dividend substitution election. If the dividend substitution election is not made, then one of the traps here for the unwary is that we say, well, there's a deemed dividend, but there's an automatic PUC suppression. Well, it's not true that there always will be an automatic PUC suppression, and because in the second case where you don't have a dividend substitution election, you have two circumstances. You have one where there's only one class of shares of the CRIC at the investment time, but if the CRIC has several classes of shares, then you have to actually trace the investment
to the particular class of shares on which you want to on which the puck is going to be suppressed. So, for instance, in a circumstance where a CRIC uses its own surplus to invest in a foreign affiliate and doesn't do a dividend substitution election, for instance, to transfer the deemed dividend elsewhere within the group to another Canadian company, then, so in other words, for instance, in a situation where you don't have any qualifying subsidiary corporation, then there's really no puck suppression if you have more than one class of shares, because you can't trace that investment in a foreign affiliate to puck that exists on a particular class of shares that's held by a non-resident. At the end of the day, what that really means is you've got to plan in advance, and maybe you send cash up as a return of capital on a class of shares, and then have the foreign parent send it back down to invest in the foreign affiliate, and boom, suddenly you have tracing. So, kind of, I guess a way to get around that possible problem. So if we're going to jump over the consequences of the puck suppression.
I may jump over the example of puck suppression as well. I think it's clear enough. Maybe we can just move to puck reinstatement.
Yeah, sure. On the puck reinstatements, essentially the idea is that you have suppressed puck. In some circumstances, that suppressed puck can be reinstated. So, for instance, where you've invested in a foreign affiliate, it applies in particular circumstances. It doesn't apply in any kind of investment. So, if the investment in the foreign affiliate by the CRIC was an acquisition of shares or a contribution of capital, then the puck in the shares of the CRIC was reduced initially by reduced initially, that's under 212.32B, or by a puck suppression, and then the CRIC makes a return of capital to the foreign parent, you get a reinstatement of the puck that was ground. So in other words, where the CRIC is returning the investment in the foreign affiliate to the parent as a return of capital, then you get the reinstated puck. And there's a similar rule for instance, where the CRIC has disposed of the investment, and there are proceeds from the investment, and seeks to return the proceeds of the investment to the foreign parent. You get a reinstatement of puck there as well. And one of the issues that in the initial proposals were that it allowed puck to be reinstated, but only in the context where you distributed the underlying investments as a return of capital. What it didn't deal with is other instances where you emigrate the Canadian corporation, emigrate the CRIC, rather than have it distribute its underlying shares. And one of the problems with distributing the underlying shares is that in certain foreign jurisdictions, a disposition of those shares, even if to a related party, can trigger certain things like stamp tax and this sort of thing. So whereas the immigration avoids that consequence, there's no disposition. The Canadian corporation continues to exist. It becomes resident in another jurisdiction, but it continues to exist. So they've amended the rule to add in 219 a rule allowing for the puck reinstatement in that context as well. I think we can jump ahead.
Skip ahead to the bump and run example, I think, just to bring some of that to life.
Yeah.
So imagine we've got a U.S. parent that wants to acquire Can Target. So standard acquisition planning, you incorporate an acquisition vehicle, the CRIC, and you fund it with $10 of equity and $5 of debt. In this example, you actually wouldn't fund it that way, but the numbers are calibrated to bring out a point here, which we'll get to. But the CRIC uses the $15 to acquire the shares of Can Target. And there we have a 10F direct acquisition. And so what you do is you allocate the $15 of the purchase price amongst the assets of the Can Target, and you see that 80% of its value derives from foreign affiliates. And so how much of the investment is attributable to those shares? Well, it'll be $12 in that example. So you'll have initially at least a deemed dividend arising of $12 that's paid to the U.S. parent by the CRIC. And automatically we have a suppression of the cross-border puck of 10. So the puck in the shares of the CRIC will be suppressed to nil. That's going to be, have the effect of reducing our $12 deemed dividend down to 2, and that $2 deemed dividend is going to be subject to withholding tax. So the next step is we're going to have a wind-up of CanTarget. CRIC's going to bump the shares of the foreign affiliate to fair market value. And then the CRIC is going to, because the U.S. parent wants to extract those foreign affiliates out of Canada, maybe to avoid these terrible rules. So the CRIC just makes a return of capital in specie of the shares of the foreign affiliates, that will be a $10 return of capital and $2 of repayment of debt. What will happen, as Derek was suggesting, there's a single class of shares of the CRIC wholly owned by the U.S. parent, so we get PUC reinstatement. We restore our $10 of cross-border PUC immediately before the return of capital, so that return of capital is not subject to 84.4, no withholding tax there, and the $2 repayment of debt is not subject to withholding tax either. The PUC reinstatement rule actually allows CRIC, for example, to sell the shares of foreign affiliate and distribute the proceeds of disposition within 180 days of that sale, and you still get PUC reinstatement for that form of the transaction as well.
I guess the other example that we wanted to go through was PUC reinstatement, or I guess a whole series of rules in the context of a typical squeeze out and a going private transaction. So in this example, you have the acquirer. I don't know why we keep putting U.S. up there, but anyways, I guess that's what most commonly is. But U.S. parent sets up a Canadian holding company, which it funds with $10 of equity, and that Canadian holding company then funds a CRIC with $10 of equity. And the reason why it's structured this way is because, the CRIC, for instance, in this case, would be the bidco in the transaction. And the Canadian holding company is set up because on the squeeze out, it's not always set up this way because sometimes the squeeze co is formed after the transaction and you don't necessarily set up with the expectation of having to squeeze out. A lot of these transactions, going private transactions, a lot of the time, you end up getting to the 90% threshold, which allows you to proceed with a compulsory acquisition. So you actually don't have to do an amalgamation squeeze out. But this example is with an amalgamation squeeze out. You want to set up your Canadian holding company because what happens is when you merge or amalgamate, I should say, CRIC and Canadian Target, and the public takes redeemable preferred shares and you redeem them, what ends up happening is you lose that PUC. So the idea of setting up Canadian holding company is so you can retain the cross-border PUC, which these rules impact on, but in a way that's not necessarily problematic as long as you can get the reinstatement. So in this transaction, when Can Hold Co. invests in the CRIC, no problem. The first kind of trigger of the rules is when the CRIC buys the first 75% of Canadian Target. And when that happens initially, and in this example, I mean, we're assuming that the foreign affiliates are represent 100% of the value. If they didn't represent 100% of the value, then you'd have to make some kind of allocation based on the value, the underlying value of the foreign affiliates. So if the foreign affiliates were worth $250, then the deemed dividend would be $250 rather than $750. But anyways, this is the example here. You have a deemed dividend of $7.50 prior to applying any of the dividend substitution elections or the PUC suppression. So a deemed dividend from CRIC up to U.S. parent typically would be subject to the higher treaty rate of withholding. But you do the dividend substitution election, which deems the dividend to be between Can Holdco and U.S. parent. And you have an automatic PUC suppression on the shares of Can Holdco held by U.S. parent of $7.50, reducing the deemed dividend to zero. So then the second step. In the second step, you do the squeeze out.
So on the squeeze out, the CRIC and the Canadian Target are amalgamated to form Can Amalco. And Can Holdco receives common shares of the Amalco on the amalgamation. Public receives redeemable preferred shares of Canadian Amalco. Now the puck of CRIC has not been ground down, so it's still the higher $10 amount. So the CRIC has sufficient puck to allocate $2.50 to the redeemable shares held by the public. The redeemable shares are then redeemed, and no deemed dividend results. What's interesting about this transaction is that one of the reorg provisions in these rules actually provide that on a vertical amalgamation, there's a deemed continuity, and you don't consider there to have been investment in a foreign affiliate. So when these are amalgamated, one might say, well, on the amalgamation of CRIC and Can Target, Amalco acquires the shares of a foreign affiliate. On a vertical amalgamation, which this is not, because the public is a minority investor here, you would have, on a vertical amalgamation, you'd have a rule that says that the Amalco is considered to be the same corporation as the predecessors and is not considered to have acquired the foreign affiliate shares on the amalgamation. So you don't have the deemed continuity here, and it does result in an investment in a foreign affiliate made by Can Amalco, and actually there is another reorg exception that applies on an 87-1 amalgamation, but that reorg exception actually requires that both predecessors be related to one another throughout the series of transactions. And if you consider that the series here includes the starting point where there were no shares held in the Canadian Target, then clearly the two predecessors were not related throughout the series. And so that reorg exception doesn't apply. So there's a potential for the foreign affiliate dumping rules to apply here. But one of the questions that arises here is that it's fine to say that you have an investment in a foreign affiliate, but in order for there to be a deemed dividend under the foreign affiliate dumping rules, you've got to have had property transferred by the CRIC. Here, it's unclear what the property transferred by the CRIC is. On the amalgamation, it's true that Amalco has issued shares, but the rules exclude the issuance of shares as being a transfer of property. So, presumably, despite the fact that you have an acquisition and an investment in a foreign affiliate, there may actually be no consequence here. And there are other ways of working around the problem by, for instance, setting up the company that amalgamates to do your squeeze-out amalgamation, setting it up after having acquired control of the Canadian Target. So then throughout the series, the two predecessors have been related. Then if we skip to the next one, which is the redemption, nothing happens on the redemption. It's not an investment in a foreign affiliate made by CRIC. We have Can Amalco and Can Holdco, and before, let's say we want to do the same thing as in the other transaction, distribute the foreign affiliate shares out, we amalgamate Can Holdco and Can Amalco to form Can Amalco 2. It's a vertical amalgamation. There's a deeming rule that says they're the same corporation, and a deeming rule that says there's no investment in a foreign affiliate as a result of the amalgamation. But the question is, when you then distribute the foreign affiliate shares out from under, do you actually get a reinstatement of PUC? The PUC reinstatement rules actually say that you get a PUC reinstatement on the same class of shares on which the PUC suppression occurred. So here, while there's a rule that says they're the same corporation, and there's a rule that says there's no investment, there's no rule that says it's the same class of shares. So kind of unclear whether in this particular circuit, I think that's the intention of the rule, but the rule is not explicit from that perspective. There seems to be a little bit of a gap in the drafting there. And I guess with that, Jeff, I'll hand it over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Derek. And mercifully, we're done. Sorry for running late. I do want to say in conclusion, we basically have a two-tier system now. We have rules that apply to a Canadian multinational who aren't subject to these FA dumping rules, and the FA dumping rules do apply to foreign multinationals. So, these guys face restrictions on base erosion and surplus stripping. The rules are complex. Yeah, there are traps for the unwary. You have to proceed with caution. But we thank you for your time, and let's turn it over to Nick.
Thanks, Jeff.
Well, thanks. thanks to Jeff and Derek for this presentation, and thanks again to the organizers of this, including Davies and Blake for the facilities they've provided us, and to you, Mike, for your organization. I should say that these slides are going to be up on the website in the next day or so. This webinar was recorded, and that'll be available to you as well. So you'll have something to refresh your memory on and to go back on a little more detail. But thanks again, Derek, and.